Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm Dr. J, and for the next half hour, I'll be your guide to a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. So keep your mind open and your radio tuned to the left. I'm speaking today with Carrie Lynn McIntosh. She's a member of the Law and Technology faculty at Santa Clara University School of Law. She's the author of many books and articles and papers about law and technology, and most recently of Illegal Beings, Human Clones, and the Law. Welcome, Counselor McIntosh.
Thank you very much.
Counselor and professor, I should say. Now, your book takes a very radical tack. There have been very few defenders of human reproductive cloning. You're principally arguing here about reproductive cloning. You're not as concerned about research cloning, although the issues are tangential. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Mm-hmm. And like Greg Pence, there are a couple other folks out there who have written books arguing for a more tolerant approach of human reproductive cloning. But as we'll get to, your arguments are quite unique in that regard. But the first part of your book is an attempt to lay out the principal objections that people have with human reproductive cloning and what sources those come from. So let's talk about a couple of those. You talk about the notion that human reproductive cloning somehow is an offense to the natural or to divine limits on human nature. And what do you say about that argument?
Well, this is an argument fundamentally about hubris or arrogance, and it plays out in two different ways on both the right and the left. The right says, you can't clone, it's against the will of God. And the left comes up with pretty much the same argument, they just state it differently. They say, you can't clone, it's against nature. But at root, both sides are arguing about the arrogance of trying to engage in this kind of activity. What I say in my book is that we really don't know what God thinks about cloning. And even humans can't agree on what God thinks about cloning. That if you go and you do the research, you find that some groups, such as the Roman Catholics, think that, of course, this is a terrible sin. But you'll find other religions, for example, they had some rabbis come in and give testimony in front of certain governmental commissions, and they said, this might be a good thing if it were used, for example, to cure infertility. So there's not agreement even among various religious groups. Then on the other side, the whole argument that this is unnatural is an argument that is based on a false idea, which is that biology somehow determines what is natural, and in fact, that's not true. What determines what we think is natural are cultural and moral values, and those change over time. So I point out in my book that when IVF was new, in vitro fertilization, back in 1978, the world was horrified by it. 85% of the public thought it should be outlawed, and people went around wringing their hands over test tube babies. They said they would be physically deformed, psychologically impaired, and so on. And all these same arguments about playing God, you know, offending nature came up at that time. But before anybody could enact a law against it, a baby was born, everybody saw how cute the baby was, and they decided maybe this wasn't such a bad thing after all. And of course, as we now know, it's been 25 years and over 1 million babies have been born worldwide through IVF, and they've brought a lot of happiness to people. But if the same harbingers of doom that are complaining about cloning today were allowed to have their way back then, those babies would not exist.
Well, it's an interesting example, and I use it often myself, but as some critics point out, the IVF was never adequately tested for the safety of the procedure at the time, and there's now some evidence that babies produced through IVF have a slightly higher rate of birth defects than babies otherwise produced. What do you say to that? I mean, is there a threshold issue here that if IVF were to have been shown, you know, should it have been regulated in the first place, and would that then apply to human cloning? And is there a certain threshold of birth defects which is unacceptable?
Well, that's actually a real big question, but let me see if I can address it piece by piece. First of all, as to IVF, those studies don't show a truly significantly higher rate of birth defects than a natural reproduction, particularly when you realize that a natural reproduction, or sexual reproduction without the aid of technology, I should say, that there's a range of birth defects in there that can go as high as 12% if you're talking about mothers as old as 40. So that there's really not a grave danger from using most IVF techniques. And I'm not sure that if it had been regulated back in 1978 that anything would have improved in that regard, because there's some possibility with these studies that whatever increased rate of birth defect there might be simply comes from the fact that you're by definition working with parents who are infertile, or they wouldn't be going to an IVF clinic in the first place. So the broader point is, at what point should the government be involved in regulating reproduction? And on that point, I would like to point out that we have always in America had a constitutional right to reproductive freedom. And we've never had a reproductive police in this country. I don't think we should start now, because sexual reproduction, quite frankly, is not safe. People forget that, but up to 75% of all embryos don't make it to birth. And then you've got that birth defect rate in the general population of 4 to 12%, but it runs much higher as 25 to 50% if what you have are carriers of heritable disease who reproduce. And nevertheless, the government has not sought to regulate sexual reproduction on safety grounds, and I think it would be a mistake to let them start working with the other more technological forms of reproduction at this point in time, because I don't think that their decisions would be based entirely on safety grounds. I think they would be based on all kinds of other grounds, which have to do with religion and morals.
That's an interesting point, because when people argue against designer babies, cloning, and human reproduction, reproductive technologies, they often talk about the eugenic experience of the past, when it was precisely the fact that the state had policies about what kinds of babies people could and couldn't have that was so problematic, and that's the reason that we enshrined this reproductive freedom principle in American jurisprudence.
Yes, and I think that the whole eugenic argument vis-a-vis cloning has been very poorly discussed. That is another thing that I take up in my book. The whole history of the eugenic movement was to come in and say, there are certain kind of children we don't want to have born because they have undesirable traits of various kinds, and therefore we will sterilize the parents who might give birth to those children and prevent those children from coming into existence. This is a form of something which I describe in my book as existential segregation, i.e., the practice of trying to stop an undesirable class from coming into existence. And to me, cloning itself presents very little prospect of being used for eugenic purposes, for reasons that I hope we'll get into later. Whereas the laws against cloning themselves, I believe, are targeted directly at human clones who are perceived as having undesirable traits. And therefore, I do believe the laws against cloning are really laws against clones. And they're very much parallel to the eugenic laws of the past, as well as parallel to laws which once prohibited interracial marriage in an effort to prevent the birth of mixed-race children.
Well, I'm speaking with Carrie Lynn McIntosh. She's at Santa Clara University School of Law, and she's the author of Illegal Beings, Human Clones, and the Law. You argue that precisely as we had laws against miscegenation on the basis of racial attitudes and policies, that the principles and logics that underlie the proposed laws against human reproductive cloning are similar and need to be stricken in order to protect people's rights. So let's expand more on that argument.
Okay, let's see what I can do with it, because it is a very complex argument. Just first, a brief note on the anti-miscegenation laws. If you go back and you look and do the research on what those laws were all about, they had multiple purposes, but a key purpose was to prevent the birth of mixed-race children on the grounds that mixed-race children were inferior in various ways. And all the same arguments, or most of the same arguments, being raised against cloning today were raised against the birth of mixed-race children. So, for example, it was declared that mixed-race unions and mixed-race children were against the will of God. It was declared that mixed-race unions and mixed-race children were unnatural. It was opined that mixed-race children would be sickly, that they would be not only physically inferior, but mentally inferior. And people even trotted out the argument that we shouldn't allow these children to be born because if they are born, they will be subject to prejudice and stigma. So they ironically used prejudice to justify more prejudice against these poor children. Now, of course, today we know all of these arguments are entirely false and racist. But as little as 50 years ago, this was all accepted as entirely correct and the right way society should be ordered, and the law had to do this to make sure that we would not end up with a world full of children who would be a burden to themselves and others.
Well, it's so, not the arguments weren't entirely wrong, because the argument that mixed-race children would be subject to prejudice was probably true, and it's probably true that clones will be subject to some prejudice, but is that a sufficient argument for interfering with people's reproductive freedom?
Well, I would argue clearly it must not be. You know, otherwise, at any time, the government could step forward and say, here is a group that the majority doesn't like. Let's stop that group from reproducing, because no matter how baseless the prejudice might be, these children, if they're born, are going to suffer, and we have to stop that. That's not an ethical argument, and I think Greg Pence, actually, in his work on cloning, does a very good job of addressing this kind of idea that if you are prejudiced against a group, you can't try to get rid of the group by using your prejudice to justify more prejudice in the form of laws that prevent that group from reproducing. That very argument was trotted forward in 1948 in California to try and justify the California anti-miscegenation laws, and the California Supreme Court had no trouble just striking it down outright. It said, and I'm going to quote here, that if mixed-race children would suffer from the stigma of inferiority, quote, the fault lies not with their parents, but with the prejudices in the community and the laws that perpetuate those prejudices by giving legal force to the belief that certain races are inferior, unquote. So all of that, I think, is essential background for the pitch I'm making in my book, which is what we're seeing again here is something similar to the anti-miscegenation laws and the eugenic laws. This policy of trying to exclude human clones from existence based on what are presumed to be their undesirable characteristics. Fundamentally, those characteristics have to do with the false idea that human clones are copies of somebody else. And I cannot emphasize this point enough. People believe, because they don't know the science, because they've been misled by science fiction, that somehow human clones are duplicates, and that cannot be. It doesn't matter if you share DNA with another person. Every person is always still an individual. We know that from our work with identical twins, for example. Identical twins are naturally occurring clones, in effect. They occur when a fertilized egg and embryo splits, and you end up with two people who share the same DNA. And identical twins have been studied to death. And what we know about them is that they may often look alike, but that their brains are not alike, their personalities are not alike, that many of the traits we come to associate with the individual are, in fact, heritable, but at a rate of only around 50%. So you then think about what clones would be like, and all the science points in the direction that they would be even more different from their DNA donors than identical twins are different from each other, because you not only now have these people being born at a different time, but you have them being gestated in a different uterus, and we know that the uterine environment has a strong impact on how genes are expressed, and we also have people being raised in a different era, in a different family, and being subjected to different social environments. So you could expect that there would be significant differences here, and indeed animal cloning experiments are already starting to bear this out, that people are not getting the duplicates that they expected. People who are cloning animals so that they can use them in experiments are finding, gee, we're not getting five identical animals like we hoped. We're getting five animals with very different personalities and behavior patterns. Or people who are cloning pets are finding out, well, this kitten that we got from this cat doesn't look anything like the DNA donor.
If the process of cloning yielded completely different animals or children, then it wouldn't be of much interest to anybody to actually do it.
Actually, I disagree with that.
Oh, you think?
Yeah, let me tell you where I think the market is for cloning, because one of the fundamental premises of my book, I think, is that human clones will be born if they can be born. And the question is, as you very correctly point out, is, hey, why would anybody want to do this? And I don't mean to say that they'll be entirely different from their DNA donors, but I don't think they're going to be the carbon copies that people expect. The people who are going to want to do this are not dictators trying to replicate themselves. They're not wealthy narcissists who, you know, want to clone themselves so that they'll be immortal, because you can't use cloning for that. The big populations that might have an interest are infertile men and women who, for one reason or another, lack functional gametes, that is, eggs or sperm. Also, people who are healthy themselves, but they carry a heritable disease, which at the moment is silent in their genome. But if they reproduce sexually, they may create a new genome in which the disease is active. And the third category that has expressed some interest in this technology might be gays and lesbians who, at present, to reproduce sexually, have to employ the gametes donated by third parties outside their relationships. And that is not something that people are always interested in doing. So for all of those people, what you're looking for is essentially genetic offspring, a child that you can't have any other way. And for that purpose, I think cloning could be very useful.
Let me go back to a point that you're making about twins, which I think is another one of the odd parts about the bioconservative arguments against cloning. They argue that they will lack individuality. And when you look at twins, you find that not only are there differences between twins, but also that twins appreciate the commonalities that they share with their twin. They find that that's an enriching part of their lives, and that in general, parents find that when they share certain traits, well, unless they're diseases and disabilities, but when they share interests with their kids, you know, that those are enriching parts of their person, their relationship with their kids, and part of the reason that you have kids in the first place. So it seems, you know, quite odd to argue that clones would be harmed somehow by sharing some significant portion of their biologically determined traits with other people.
I agree with that. And in fact, Dr. Nancy Siegel, who is a renowned twin researcher, has spoken on cloning and has pointed this out, that people, in fact, enjoy being twins. You know, they're not psychologically harmed by being twins. Instead, it's beneficial to them in most cases. And also, I think we forget sometimes just how similar parents and children can be, even when no cloning is involved. And people get a lot of pleasure out of the fact that they're like a parent, or the parent gets a lot of pleasure out of the fact that the child is a lot like them. So this may be simply a matter of degree. Nevertheless, the opponents argue that this is different from twins because twins still have an open future. They don't, in effect, know how they're going to, quote-unquote, turn out, whereas a clone would somehow have a closed future. They would always be looking over their shoulder and thinking, look, I have to do what my DNA donor did. I just don't think that's human nature. I think that people would pretty quickly realize that, look, you know, I've got my life. I can live it any way I want, and I'm not my parent, whether I share the same genome or not.
One of the arguments that Francis Fukuyama deploys against cloning in his book, Our Post-Human Future, is always one that just brought me up short with its absurdity. He argued that if a mother were to clone herself, and then the family was to raise this clone of the mother, that the father would have some overwhelming sexual attraction to the daughter because she would be a teenage version of the mother, which seems to imply that most daughters don't look like their mothers to begin with, which is obviously not true, and that men don't have sexual attractions for women who don't look like their wives, which is also not true, or teenage girls that don't look like their wives. So what his argument seems to imply is that we should all be switching kids at birth to minimize the possibility that any of our kids would look like our spouses. Just completely absurd.
Yeah, well, that is, I think, a very pernicious argument, because it is absurd for the reasons you point out, and at the same time, it is a not-so-subtle way of smearing cloning and clones and associating them with incest, which has its own ugh factor. But Steven Pinker, who I think is at Harvard now, has pointed out that in general, people are not attracted to their children and vice versa, just as brothers and sisters are not attracted to each other, that we have evolved over time to not feel attraction to people generally who are a part of our family groups. And there's every reason to believe the same would occur if you were working with a cloned son or daughter, that you would not see that person as somehow being your spouse. I think the identity fallacy is also at work here, that people can't seem to get past this idea that the DNA donor and the clone are one and the same. And again, that is simply not true, any more than it's true that an identical twin and his or her sister or brother are somehow one and the same. So if identical, you might as well say, in response to Fukuyama, that no identical twin should ever marry, because the spouse would inevitably be attracted to his or her twin, and it would just be a setup for adultery.
That's a good argument. I'm speaking with Carrie Lynn McIntosh. She's the author of Illegal Beings, Human Clones and the Law. Now, another one of the bioconservative arguments, even if they accept all the things that you're saying, they point further in the future and they say, look, where is it leading us if we start having cloning and designer babies and all these other manipulations of humanity? It's leading us in such an unknown direction that on the basis of the precautionary principle or just general cautiousness, we should stop here and have a real long think about all this. Now, what's the problem with that argument? It is true that it's leading in an unknown direction, but my argument would be, which seems to be your argument also, that the individual rights which are in question are so important that we can't stop here and stop anybody from doing this.
Yes, and I would add to that the following. First of all, as I've suggested, cloning is not replication. So you're not going to be designing any babies with cloning, not really. You're not going to be able to go out there and produce multiple Einsteins. Nor is genetic engineering at this point in time a particularly imminent possibility. We just don't know enough about the interaction of genes with each other or genes in the environment to be able to engage in this kind of designer baby project that Fukuyama and others fear. So we're talking fairly far down the road in any event. In terms of, well, what's the harm of having these laws? The harm is not only to the reproductive freedom of the adults involved, but I think it's also very much to the children who are going to be born in defiance of these laws. Because I think if the abortion experience, for example, has taught us anything, it's that making a certain reproductive choice illegal doesn't mean that people don't go out and do it anyway. And then you really have to factor into your public policy analysis the costs. When you have a large population of children who have been born through cloning, and yet they're living in a society which has chosen through its laws to condemn their very existence, this, again, is what I call existential segregation, and it seems to me that it's every bit as harmful as racial segregation, where you take a certain kind of person who, for whatever reason, you don't like, and you put that person in a separate community with separate schools, separate parks, and so forth. That's just one way of trying to segregate people. If instead you use these laws to try and keep human clones from being born, and they're born anyway, then you bring them into society as essentially subhuman defective duplicates, because that's what your laws have labeled them to be. You're going to be talking, if you're serious about these laws, about putting their parents into prison. You're going to be talking about telling these children throughout their lives that their own democratically elected government thinks that they're subhuman. You're going to be encouraging people to pass, just as gays and lesbians sometimes are required to pass today, to protect themselves against discrimination. And I think that overall does far more harm to our egalitarian society than anything that cloning itself could ever do.
Your bracketing of the notion of designer babies and human genetic enhancement, I understand. But another kind of case that people deploy against a radical procreative liberty argument in this case would be something like sex selection, where they argue that in India or China or even in the West, the consequences of widespread sex selection would be so deleterious for society that you would not be able to allow procreative liberty in this case. Do you think that any of your arguments reflect on that particular case?
Probably the best way of trying to combat sex selection is to combat sexism itself. To that extent, I think it's consistent with the message of my book, which is, you know, that if you, you know, feel this yuck factor, look to yourself. And ask yourself, is this rational? And should I be indulging in these emotions, which I think at root are very bigoted emotions? If you really want to stop sex selection, what you do is you work to improve the status of women in society. I think making or trying to make that kind of activity illegal is simply going to be fruitless.
Well, in fact, the Indian Medical Association has proposed that no Indian woman should be able to see her ultrasound because of the difficulty of controlling their choices. And conversely, the Chinese have adopted the relatively progressive notion that they'll give free college education to girls in order to encourage families to have girls. That seems to be a much more liberal policy. My final question would be, do you think that there is a growing awareness of the implications of procreative liberty that you're trying to articulate in this book among legal scholars? Because John Robertson got slammed when he wrote Children of Choice and when he recently suggested that sex selection might be acceptable practice for the American Fertility Association. And there, so there have been very few legal scholars who have been willing to articulate much less a constitutional right that you have argued for here, but a general right to procreative liberty in this area.
I don't know whether the balance is tilting in that direction, but I do want to add one point about my book. Although my book does talk about procreative liberty, the core of the book really is to talk about equal protection and how these laws discriminate against human clones in the same way that segregation in the Deep South used to discriminate against African Americans. So what I'm trying to do is certainly support John Robertson and others who make those kinds of arguments, but at the same time add a new line of attack, which is to say that if human clones can be born, they will. Once they're here, they will have the standing to challenge these laws on the grounds that these laws are doing serious damage to them and that they are being treated differently than people who were conceived via sexual reproduction for essentially no good reason whatsoever. And that, I think, is the one thing that's going to blow this debate apart, for people to have to look in the eye a person who is conceived from through human cloning and say to them, I don't want your kind around here. You know, you don't deserve to live. Are people going to be willing to do that? Or are they suddenly going to realize that this is not a profitable way to deal with this technology or with their fellow man?
I've been speaking with Carrie Lynn McIntosh. She's the author of Illegal Beings, Human Clones, and the Law, which is available at any local bookstore. And she's a professor at Santa Clara University School of Law. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. If you want to learn more about democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts with me, Dr. J, you can contact me at jhughes@changesurfer.com. That's jhughes@changesurfer.com. Or you can read my Change Surfing columns at betterhumans.com or check out the collaborative Cyborg Democracy blog I participate in at cyborgdemocracy.net. Or you can read my new book, Citizen Cyborg. For more details about Citizen Cyborg, visit cyborgdemocracy.net. At the Change Surfer website, you can find past and future shows archived in streaming MP3, thanks to the AInfos radio project. So educate, agitate, and organize, and I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.